Thanks to popular demand, Paul Hudson can't make it to our podcast recording today. I'm Graham Morrison.
I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
And I'm Paul Hudson. Gosh, no. I almost didn't make it.
Quit.
Okay. Welcome to episode 17 of the Tux Radar podcast. Don't forget, we're publishing news, features and more on tuxradar.com, so bookmark it today. In this episode, we have news of the first Linux web server botnet. The new kernel 2.6.31 has been released. A hot topic, MonoTouch finally brings Mono to the iPhone, is that good or bad? And our open ballot, should we, as a journalist community, focus more on non-Linux Unixes? And before our landlord kicks us out onto the street, please subscribe, give us some money, help us live like real men. Subscribe at tinyurl.com/LXFpodcast. And definitely not tinyurl.com/podcastlxf. One of the two will work. Try them both. Please subscribe! So yes, the news. Of course, top story this week. The first Linux botnet has been discovered, which is, of course, wonderful news because it proves that Linux is now mature enough to run botnet software. What do you think, folks? Are you excited?
It's got 100 nodes have been discovered so 100. Far, so that makes it quite a baby in terms of botnets.
Not millions.
No, it's a little fledgling thing. And they are running the NG-INX web server, which is a
otherwise known as Nginx.
Nginx, well, that's most... I've never heard anybody pronounce it in real life, I'm afraid.
Go on, Graham, pronounce Vim for us.
VI.
Yes, Nginx. But you remember, these 100 nodes, they are all hooked up to fast internet connections and with very, very high uptimes, unlike most home PCs and dial-up or whatever.
Unlike some Windows 98 bots.
Exactly, yeah.
I think it goes to show that a lot of Linux admins are perhaps complacent. They assume that just because they're running Linux, they've already got a machine that's secure, you know, and fail to update regularly. That's still important.
Is it down to the updates, though?
Well,
is that really what you think caused it?
Possibly, you know, there are holes discovered all the time and are swiftly patched in the free software world.
So is it an exploit in the web server that's been exploited?
No, keep on guessing.
Is it autonomous? Has it spread to those?
No. The guy thinks he's detecting 2 new IP addresses every hour, which seems like an awful lot given there's only 100 other things so far. But yeah, his belief is that it's more likely to be careless sysadmins had the root password sniffed.
Right.
Which is going to happen whether you're running OS X, Windows, or MacOS.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we've talked about it before. Linux isn't any more intrinsically secure through passwords.
If you save your passwords in passwords.txt, you're boned no matter what OS you're on.
Well, your password is password.
Password one.
Yes, but it means that Linux is finally getting out there in the botnet world, which might scare some users, perhaps.
Right. Time to move to OpenBSD, then, I think.
Or maybe Ubuntu will start coming with a virus checker.
That's true.
What do you reckon, Andrew?
I think we should give credit to the chap who you called this guy. It's Dennis Sinagubko, who's done the work and found this botnet. But why now? Why is it new? Why have there not been more Linux botnets discovered? What's changed?
A good question.
What we need Listeners. Is a group of Linux experts to sit around and discuss the
What is the botnet doing? We've got very little information.
Well, okay, keep in mind, botnets are nothing new, right?
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if the first botnet ran on Linux because it was egg drop. The old IRC days, right?
Yeah.
The old days, and it probably ran on Linux because Windows didn't even have internet back then, if I can remember correctly.
Well, I'm sure the original definition of a botnet isn't something malicious.
No, exactly.
It's just
yeah.
a bunch the first of botnets machines communicating. Linux. Yeah,
but now they're malicious.
Now they're actually
not quite sentient. But
shouldn't a sysadmin know what he's running on his machines?
Ah, yes, but as Mike said, it uses Nginx, which is an alternate web server running on a different port. So Apache, whatever you're running, carry on runs fine on port 80. Looking normal, serving out normal web pages, but on port 8080, it's running Nginx with hideous virus stuff. So you think your system's running fine, unless you run nmap frequently or look for open ports or whatever. You think it's fine. It looks fine. You can't tell the difference. I mean, you know, Nginx isn't unusual. I think we use it here at Future, actually.
So basically all that's happened is that these machines have had their system administrator account compromised.
Yep.
And people have got in and installed Nginx, and that's all the news is.
It is, but it is serving up vast amounts of botnet stuff to Windows clients.
What's the problem?
it's a Linux botnet, yes, but it's actually acting as sort of master botnet to a Windows botnet.
But what's the botnet
as a
part?
Food chain.
What's the server that's keeping all these machines glued together?
Skynet. Moving on, Haiku has had an alpha released. Mike, what's your response to that in a Haiku form, please?
Well, I've
575, Mike, you can do it.
Oh, no, not off the top of my head.
Nearly.
Really, thanks for counting. I've been following Haiku for a while. Well, about the last 8 years, really. It was OpenBIOS and... but the team have explicitly made it very difficult to use, to try out up until now. They haven't produced CD images until this alpha release, because they didn't want people reporting all the bugs that they knew was there and all the other problems associated with it. So now with the alpha, they're actually ready to put it out into the masses. And basically it just looks and feels like OpenBIOS. Well, a BIOS, I should say.
Do you know what haiku is, Mike?
Yep.
that was like six haikus strung together.
I'm not going to actually try here on the spot to do a haiku. Well, I can do if you want, but it will waste Graham's time.
Great.
I can do a mumbling haiku.
Go on. Well, I looked at it when you put it up, Mike, and it does look like the old KDE theme still. The little tiny yellow toolbars, as if nothing's really changed.
But that's the idea. They want to just... they don't want to set their goals too high for the first release. The first release is meant to basically be BIOS, back as it was in 2001. So it doesn't sound particularly impressive or amazing, but they didn't want to get into the state of like ReactOS, where they kept chasing more and more and going further and further. They want to get a solid release out the door, which will be quite a simple OS, and then, you know, expand on it from there. But it's already very fast and lightweight, so I'm impressed.
Are you going to switch?
Yeah, in the beta release.
Should we all switch for 2 weeks?
I did a 30 days with the Haiku article.
You did?
Yeah, about 18 months ago.
And that had actual haikus in it. That was really cool.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We should put that online. Is it online already?
I don't think it is.
All those TuxBR listeners who don't buy the format, I'm heathen scum.
I really loved it. I mean, the great thing was it booted so quickly.
Yeah.
But the biggest disadvantage was there were hardly any applications I could run on it. I mean, just getting Firefox.
Was there no Firefox? Yes, they fixed that, didn't they? See afterwards.
Yeah.
There is a native Firefox port at the moment, yeah. So, I mean, the goal is compatibility with BOS. So, you know, there are a lot of old games and emulators and apps out there. Yeah. Abbey Word as well has a port.
I mean, yeah, it's binary compatible, which is fantastic.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Very clever.
And your haiku?
I can't remember. I did a mumbling one.
Haikus are easy, but sometimes they don't make sense. Refrigerator.
My favourite one. Sometimes 17 syllables ain't enough to express a... Moving on. Linux 2.6.31 has been released. And Con Colivas is back, isn't he? He's with a new scheduler.
This time it's personal.
This time we can't even say its name because he's put a swear word into it. But the new kernel release has some interesting features. It's got USB 3.0 support. Years for any devices come. And it's got support for Intel's latest network cards, which aren't released till next year, which is awfully, wonderfully future-looking.
That is cool, though. I mean, if you map that on a timescale of Linux driver support.
Well, that's exactly the thing, isn't it? It's very often you get new distros coming out after 6 months, and they're like... devices are coming out at the same time and they haven't got support for them. You have to wait 6 more months. Whereas now, if the next kernels that come out, like, you know, Ubuntu's and your SUSE's and your Fedora's, all ship with this kernel, it'll mean they actually have drive support as the devices are appearing, which is kind of how it should be, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, is that thanks to Intel then? Is Intel part
Intel
of
always, Intel always frees its drivers nowadays, which is great.
And I guess they're part of the, they are a big part of the USB.
They are. But I find the USB thing a bit confusing actually, because USB 1.1 was called full speed. 2.0 is called high speed. 3.0 is called super speed.
Wow.
Which means that 4.0 is called ludicrous speed.
They sort of shot themselves in the foot by calling the first one full speed, didn't they?
Well, that was done actually after the fact, retrospectively, because they thought that when 2.0 was released high speed, no one would want the old stuff anymore, unsurprisingly, because it's slower. So they looked at a way to rebrand it, so a lot of manufacturers called it full speed to imply that it was 2.0, but isn't. It was a cunning marketing ploy to confuse consumers, and they got away with it, apparently, too, without getting sued into dust. But I think there are some performance boosts as well in the new kernel.
There are. There's better memory management, and apparently with fixes to EXD 3 and 4, file system reads are 3% faster.
which really adds up, apparently.
It would add up on a
botnet.
On a botnet.
Well, there's an awesome quote here from Stephen J. Vaughan Nichols. He said, under the old memory behaviour, your performance could slow down by 1,000% or more.
What?
Which shows a dramatic lack of mathematics skill, I think. But Con Colabasta's back with a new scheduler. And anyone know anything about it?
Well, like you say, it's got a name which implies it probably won't get into the kernel. And I saw
it's called BFS, and if Graham could do the beeping sound, it's called the Brain... Brain Beep Scheduler. Because it throws everything out about what we know is good about how to design a modern scheduler in scalability, apparently.
What a dude.
Says Con.
That sounds ace.
Well, I think we should have pluggable schedulers in the kernel.
Explain what it means first.
I think we should be able to have... So a scheduler guarantees which processes run and switch between them. So you've got schedulers geared towards desktop performance, and you've got schedulers geared towards servers as well. And historically, the kernel has only had one. So it's one scheduler trying to do all these different jobs for different types of machines. But I think we should be allowed to change them, just like we can try different file systems for different tasks and scenarios. Because
isn't the current one called the completely fair scheduler?
Yeah, but I don't want a fair scheduler. I want one that puts complete bias and priorities. Yeah, yeah. I still have a problem now. When I'm running make ISOFS, making an LXF DVD, it just freezes up the box effectively. Firefox just grinds to a halt because of this activity in the background. So
can't you just change its priority? Does that?
I could do, but I don't want to, end up renicing.
You'd much rather put in a whole new scheduler.
Yeah, make iPhone. I want somebody else to do the work, so that a background disk-intensive task takes 10 seconds longer. But
actually, a problem we've had in the past, and it does annoy me no end, is if your server's under heavy load and you try and log in, it'd be like, "No, I'm sorry, root, you can't do that." And you're like, "No, I'm just forget Apache temporarily.
Yeah.
I am more important. I want to see what's going on." But that shouldn't happen.
By default, a root login should take priority.
It's a problem we've had for years with computers, isn't it? I remember the Amiga; you could change the scheduler. I used to spend ages.
Really?
Yeah. I used to spend ages messing around with Task Manager on the Amiga, just seeing which one would render my imagined scenes faster.
Amiga in better than Linux Shocker.
Possibly. I mean, it didn't really do any good.
So, if there's one scheduler for all Linux kernels at the moment, does that mean that your Acer Aspire 1 is
it's here next to me
is prioritizing servers just as much as the Linux format server.
Yeah.
That's not very clever, is it?
No. No. Well, wasn't there something ages ago about prioritizing interactive stuff?
Yeah, I remember that coming up.
Was that replaced by the completely fair scheduler that ignores what you're doing and does what it wants to do?
There was the O1 scheduler or something, wasn't there? Or the ON. I forget. Yeah, I remember it coming up, but nothing seemed to happen.
The idea being that if you're working in X, it's quite important.
Yeah.
And, Apache can do what it likes, but I'm working in X, quite frankly, get off.
Well, like Graham says, you can re-nice stuff yourself. You can go around re-nicing processes to change priorities, but you shouldn't have to.
But that was the point, that X stuff started at a higher priority.
I think it does anyway. Yeah, I think some distros have done it. They've run it at priority minus 19 or 19, one of them. Whichever one's the fastest.
That's extreme, isn't it? Isn't that before doing anything else?
Yeah, I think it is, just so that you can always move the mouse cursor. Yeah.
What's minus 19 in percentage terms?
Minus 1,000%.
He gave lots of great reasons why it's good. And he says, because it performs so ridiculously well on what it's good at, despite being simple. It's designed in such a way that mainline would never be interested in adopting it, which is how I like it. Well, I'm not quite sure why he's doing the work then, but there you go.
Well, he's probably bitter from previous.
Yeah, he had a bit of a bad time, didn't he? Previously.
Yeah.
He also says, because it will make people sit up and take notice of where the problems are in the current design, which... sort of lays things down a little bit, doesn't it?
Does that mean we could get a full-scale kernel fork then? If this scheduler is really, really good, and Linus doesn't want to put it in the kernel,
because he hates Con.
Colibas doesn't want to put it in the kernel, then is it time for somebody to step up and make...
Well, presumably it's GPL, so
they
can stick it in the kernel.
They can just do it the last time and re-implement it under a different name.
Yeah.
Like Ice Weasel.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure Ingo has already been involved looking at the patches and stuff, and has tried to be friendly and welcoming, saying welcome back and let's do it together and work on it. And Com's response was blah, read the FAQ.
Well, yeah, he's given it a name that's, you know, not very palatable.
No.
But I wonder if the actual design and the code, maybe he's written the code deliberately really ugly or obfuscated in order to stop it getting in.
Quite possibly.
This fortnight's hot topic is Novell releasing Mono Touch for the iPhone. Mono Touch is a software development kit for iPhone developers to use Mono and C Sharp to develop iPhone applications rather than Apple's Objective-C and its SDK. The reason why this is interesting to us as Linux users is because it's based on the Mono toolkit, the open source toolkit developed by Novell and released for free. Is this a good thing? I mean, the thing is, it's expensive. For a single user, if you're just a personal user who wants to publish your own apps, it's going to cost you $399 US.
Per year.
Per year. Yeah, just a year of updates. After that, you're isolated. I mean, that single user also is non-transferable. So I couldn't let you use it for an hour while I go out for lunch.
Really?
For that, you need the Enterprise Edition, which is $1,000 per year.
Per developer.
Per developer, yeah. Well, you can get a 5-developer license for $3,999.
Whoa.
Is that like $4,000?
Yeah. Almost.
Yeah.
Is this for making apps to deploy around your business, or can you actually get stuff into the App Store? Has Apple approved anything
yet? Well, it's for both. It's for both. They'll be hoping that the personal edition is for people who would rather program in C# and use Mono.net 3.5.
I'm just wondering if Apple will allow these apps into the App
Store. Yeah, they already have something like 200 apps based on C# in the App Store.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. So you can do it.
It works around the restriction of, I mean, the iPhone doesn't allow you to do any just-in-time compilation.
Yeah.
That's how Java works. So it pre-compiles everything.
Everything to ARM?
Everything, yeah. Everything across the board.
Binary.
Completely flat binary.
Right.
It works, yeah. But the difference is that the Enterprise one can do ad hoc deployment, whereas personal one can't.
It does sound really cool technology.
It sounds, I mean, I'd be really interested in it if it was cheaper. Yeah. I mean, it's just, I can't even envisage trying it out, you know, if it's going to cost me $399 in the end to publish an app with it.
Do you think this price is so high at the start to recoup the development costs? Because it's obviously been a lot of work.
I don't know. It seems to me, after, you know, following Miguel de Casa, whose project it is, following his blog over the last 12 months while this has been happening, it seems to me that it started off as a personal project because it was kind of cool, and Novell have taken it up because they've obviously seen it's got a commercial potential. And coming from the open source world, and look, we've talked about Mono a lot, that seems a little bit incongruent and a bit disappointing. And I can't imagine Novell making enough money that they're going to be able to make a business out of it.
Well,
so why
it works with Unity, doesn't it? Have you seen Unity?
Yes,
before?
Yeah, Unity is great.
That's a 3D OpenGL implementation on C# on Mono.
Yeah.
Also closed source.
Yeah.
They're making money.
Yeah, and they've seen them making money out of Unity 3D.
Exactly.
And they've thought, you know, 200 apps published through that, they could publish it through Mono Touch.
Mm, exactly, yeah. And it would recoup the cost. It wouldn't be profitable, I doubt, but it would recoup the cost.
Yeah. I think it's very cool technology.
Well, how much are you interested in it then, Paul? You'd love C#. You're programming on the iPhone.
If it were open source, I'd be using it today.
Yeah, you think it would really be...
Technologically, it is so superior to what Apple has turned out.
Right.
It's embarrassing for Apple, I think.
Really?
Yeah, they've done an awesome job.
Even against the whole Xcode frame system.
What they've done with the Xcode thing, with the .nibs, basically the interface files, is incredible. They've basically taken the Mono Develop approach, using something called partial classes. Very, very advanced technology stuff, and it's great. Love it. But it's not free. And that really irks me. You know, one of the reasons I didn't really like... Qt originally was because of the funny licensing.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, is that still the case, funny licensing? Like GPL, unless you want to be closed source, we have to do it again from scratch or whatever.
It was
messy licensing, basically. I never really liked that.
But that's a technicality in the license.
It is, I know, but the thing is, I chose to commit to Mono because I thought it was a great platform on Linux, right? Free, open. Mm. And afterwards, now they're moving the goalposts a little bit. They're saying, hey, now this bit over here, if you want to do that, well, that's not free anymore. And that's actually very irritating. I wouldn't, and it now makes me feel a bit dirty for using Mono in the first place, because it's now no longer a free platform on Linux, or at least fully anyway. You can't go across and do more with it. There are limitations, and that's irritating for me.
They should actually have a free version if your apps are going to be free.
Yeah, there you go.
Like Qt.
Well, yeah, but it's all mixed up
that
with Apple.
That would be incredible.
It's all mixed up with Apple Store kind of policy. So at some point, you've got to pay a developer's license, and it's going to be closed source to a degree.
But yeah, but if your app is actually licensed under the GPL.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what the iPhone, other non-Unix platforms are really missing. Stacks of great free software.
Yeah, yeah.
I know OS X's got some and Windows has got some, whatever, but there's so much more on Linux that never gets ported. And if they had the same thing on iPhone, it'd be incredible. Just everything free, 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 free. Show Apple how it's supposed to be, you know, make the iPhone free, at least on the app side.
Yeah.
It'd be incredible. And they could do that very easily.
Yeah, they wouldn't lose any money from that.
They wouldn't, no. Or at least if they said, hey, once we recoup our costs, we'll make it a free version available. GPL, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, if you're spending $399 on the personal edition, you're going to hope to make a lot of money. So it doesn't matter. You know, those people can have their commercial products, and people are interested in creating a quick app using Mono on their iPhone, they can.
Shame also that it's per year.
Yeah.
That seems really tight.
Yeah, I agree. It's especially coming from the open source world, that kind of thing is just so unfamiliar now.
Yeah,
it's the kind of the world that we left a long time ago.
Correct,
and especially from a company that fully understands that, and people who fully understand that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the thing. I've never really liked Unity for the same reason. You know, it's wonderful stuff, really amazing toolkit, but not free.
Yeah, yeah.
They've taken something that was free and closed it.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, I mean, all respect to the BSD folks, it does irritate me no end. The fact that people have put so much work into it and they just take it and make it closed.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not how it should be, I don't think.
But does Novell really understand free software, open source? I mean, this is the same crowd of people who invented the mixed source.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. We're presumably with Miguel de Casa at the helm of this particular project, you know, there are going to be few better people.
Sure, but then I'm sure.
To understand.
I'm sure Miguel didn't come up with the pricing policy.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, how much effort, Paul, has this taken? I mean, would it be difficult for the community to do a similar thing with Mono?
Well, the thing is, it's taken a lot of effort, but most effort has been open sourced already.
Right.
So they put a lot of work into the ahead of time compile stuff. I showed you ages ago, we talked about it off the podcast, something called Fire Engine for PC.
Yes, yes, yeah, yeah.
That's the Sony toolkit for making games. They made a binding to that for C# Fire Engine.
Yeah.
And inside that took a lot of work to make all the ahead of time compilation stuff work. That kind of work's already done. So they ported that to the iPhone, fair enough, the ARM, fair enough, that makes sense. Then they had to do bindings for all the stuff. Not terribly easy. Then they had to make Mono Develop work on Mac, which they did
yeah,
recently.
Yeah.
As of 2.2, it's now officially cross-platform. And they had to do the whole bit in between, the Xcode push stuff. You have to be able to push to the iPhone, don't you? Push it out to the iPhone. So there has been some new work done. Not a lot. But some.
It is feasible that the community, if there was enough demand, could create an open source version.
Of course it's feasible, yeah. They've done all the basic work there already. You want to share that and just modify the bits on top. It is feasible. I don't think it's going to happen because Novell has a history of anyone skilled in this area, they'll just hire or intern or get working very, very closely with them.
And also, this is going to be only feasible for OS X users, Apple OS X users, who perhaps aren't going to worry about spending $400 on an SDK.
Yeah, maybe they're used to it.
Yeah,
they obviously are used to it. You know, they're spending money on tools and stuff on iPhone. On the that's it, £60, $100 a year. That's pay for the right to do iPhone apps anyway. It's not so it all adds up, and they probably are used to it by this point. So
yeah, yeah.
But as free software users, it just irks me that they think this is okay.
And the stratospheric pricing as well. I mean, it's not even...
It's not cheap in the slightest.
No, it's not. You can't say it's like Crossover Office or something like that, you know, which is perfectly reasonably priced.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you don't really begrudge them their proprietary version.
Sure. When you pay 30 quid towards it, you think, hey, I'm helping fund Wine.
Yeah, yeah, and exactly. And all that work goes back into Wine.
Exactly,
it's
yeah.
Not exactly the case here.
Well, obviously, any money you pay towards them will show them that Mono's good and will help fund Mono and stuff. And they have to make money from Mono somehow, don't they? They have to get something back from it.
Has that been their motivation? I don't know. Maybe this is the real...
The real story behind Mono coming out all along was we can make money by closed sourcing bits.
When it gets to a critical mass, you know, Novell are going to take Mono and really capitalise on the fact that it owns the source code.
You heard it here first. And with such stirring anti-Novell debate, we come to the halfway reminder still to come. Discovery of the fortnight /week/month and our open ballot. Should we focus on other Unixes than just Linux? And just, I know people are wondering, just so you know, we are well aware that Linux is not technically a Unix.
And with all those japes, we come to Discovery of the Week. Now, who to go first? Eeny, meeny, miny.
That was you then.
Yeah, so it was. My discovery of the week is MDD Clone, which is an open source, well, not open source, but it's a modern re-implementation of Mercenary, Damocles, and Dion Crisis, or Dion Crisis.
But it's a Windows program. It's a Windows game.
No, it's on Linux now.
Really?
Is this news?
Is news, because I know MDD Clone well. I'm still subscribed to the mailing list.
Really? Yeah. It's on Linux. For those who've never heard of it before...
You don't read the mailing list, do you?
No, it uses a terrible format, but that's something else. It posts the links to new messages, and you have to click on the link to go back to the forum to read the message. So,
for those who've never heard of it before, Mercenary was a game released in 1985 for the classic 8-bit platforms, and it was incredible. It was a full first-person 3D planet exploration game, and you could also go in buildings and fly aircraft and stuff, and it was sensational for such old...
I can remember the day I got back from Derby Market. I put the tape in my Commodore 64, loaded it up. And what happens is at the very beginning, you see your spacecraft crash into some planet like that. Mm. And all you see is like this airport building, a cube, and this thing that looks like a dart on the runway a car. And you just can't believe it. At the time, it's just... amazing.
And you walk around and you explore. And for the time, it was...
There's no instructions as well, I remember the game. They just gave you basic key commands. So you walked over to that salt and pepper pot car-shaped thing. You press B and it would board. And then you could press 1, 2, 3 and it would speed up down the road.
And to go to the destination.
I felt like the whole world was open to me.
So it might not be so mind-blowing for people today, but... The thing with MDD Clone is there's an SDL version which looks just like the original, very wireframe, and there's an OpenGL version with lots of extra textures as well. Have you seen that?
No. Because Mercenary was wireframe, Damocles was filled in vectors.
Was it? Amiga days. So yeah, I only really played Mercenary. I only really knew Mercenary. But
so
yeah,
presumably they've done that for Damocles.
It must be. Yeah, the OpenGL versions look great. So. I highly recommend
That's
it.
That's a fantastic find. I'm going to go straight
you.
Back and
I'll go now.
Oh, mine's going to look really poor after that.
Graham.
Okay. Mine is the discovery that the Windows 7 color palette looks really good on KDE 4.
How does I?
It looks really good.
Well, did you run it through Wine or something?
No, I just happened to be messing with my color settings. And you can do this from the system settings application in KDE, clicking on appearance and then colors. And then you can be really anal about it and change all of the colors, but mainly change the window background to an HTML value of B7D0E6, which is that pale blue color used kind of by Vista on Windows 7. And I think it looked great on the KDE desktop.
Wow.
It really, really made my desktop feel completely new and clean and
refreshed.
Changing
the background color.
Yeah. It's just the window background. I mean, also changing the button background to CFDCE9, and it transforms the KDE desktop. I think it's a great color. They should even think about it as the default for next time. Because
surely D9 is better than E9.
Yeah, well,
D9 kind of guy.
Yeah.
Can we get a screenshot of this then in the podcast notes? Yeah. Great.
Yeah. So all this time they've been messing around with plasmoids and stuff.
Just change the color palette. I mean, there are actually plenty of Windows 7 color palettes you can get with KDE by clicking on the Get Hot New Stuff and download them that way, but really just change the window background color.
Do you think it'll work in XFCE as well?
In fact, it'll work equally well because it's just the color.
Would you like to hear some awesome trivia?
Yeah, go on.
A sister magazine of Linux formats, I'm not going to mention which one, but you can probably figure it out, recently shipped a DVD with a Windows 7 customization toolkit that made your Vista look like Windows 7. And they had to yank the CD at the last minute because they recognized it actually did that by copying all the Windows 7 icons into an .exe file and basically all the backgrounds as well.
Dear.
So they realized they're ripping off Microsoft massively. They had to yank it at the last minute.
That's terrible.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was someone's idea to do this, apparently. Yes. But they realized at the last minute for
without knowing what it did, yeah.
Without realizing, yeah. So, yes, interesting. That
Super Mario Chronicles revisited.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually an interesting point because some of the themes on the KDE Lux website do include the bitmaps from Windows, which is bad. We shouldn't be doing that.
No, shouldn't be doing that.
No, I mean, distros have got to be careful not to include these things, but yeah.
Hex values for colors, can we steal those from Microsoft?
They're the copyright, aren't they?
Yeah. Change them a little bit.
The overall experience is probably copyrighted. Paul?
I've got two.
Two?
Two, yes.
As usual.
Now, yeah, the first one's really interesting because I discovered while I was off sick last week, I was trawling through Wikipedia like I always do, and I discovered why why the US flag flies backwards on the space shuttle. I hadn't realised before, but if you look at it, it's backwards.
Okay.
There's actually a reason.
I thought they'd reverse the motor.
Not a mistake, yeah.
It's conspiracy theory,
so they
isn't
didn't
it?
Actually land on the moon. So you can see it's flipped.
But apparently, it's the rules. It's actually by rules that the American flag flown on aircraft must look like the mast of the flag is next to the nose cone. So the flag is flying in the wind. Hence, the shot goes forwards. The flag must go backwards in the wind as it flies.
Oh, I thought it was if you were in a jet in front and you were looking through your rear view mirror and then you'd see it normally, like when it says ambulance backwards.
Yeah,
on it.
No, it's not. It's because of that.
What do they do when their aeroplanes reverse?
Maybe it's like a hologram. The angle you look at it perhaps changes.
LCD monitor.
Incidentally, I saw both the International Space Station and the Space Shuttle in the sky.
Really? From lovely south of France?
Yeah, across the sky, one following the other. It was magnificent. Ooh.
Great.
Yeah.
Or you had something in your eye.
Yeah.
Moving on, my actual discovery of the week is just actually something to help a listener out. A chap called Hugh wrote in to say this. There seems to be some confusion within the Ubuntu community regarding the feature known as a computer janitor. I've looked for answers on the web a few times, and there don't seem to be many people who know whether it's safe to use. I certainly have been brave enough to try it. So my discovery of the week is really to actually look into it and find out what it actually does. And it does three things. Computer janitor does three things. Firstly, it removes things that were installed as dependencies that are no longer needed. So libraries and stuff. If you install KDE4 like we did recently, get it on there, then you remove KDE, but leave behind libkde, foobar, bars, whatever. It thought it needed them. It did need them for a while, but now it's no longer needed. It will remove those. Secondly, it will remove packages that are no longer supported and therefore may be a bit shaky or uncertain on your distro. And thirdly, it adds any configuration tweaks that were made in newer distros that weren't applied to your system. So these are quite good. The first thing's nice because it frees up disk space you don't need anymore. Good. Last two can be dangerous, I think. Configuration tweaks, they were added in, say, 9.04. You may have changed something else in your 8.04 for upgraded, so they may have been applied for a reason. I'd be a bit careful using that one. And the middle one, removing packages that aren't supported, is a bit dangerous because we tried a mic system and it wanted to remove VirtualBox, which it actually likes and uses all the time.
Yeah, that's because I'd installed it from the VirtualBox site.
So it wants to remove that, which is a bit lame.
Yeah,
so if all you want to do is remove packages that are no longer needed, dependencies, what you have to do is run apt-get auto-remove, and it'll do the same thing from the command line. Although you can use computer janitor to see what it would do. You click the command, it'll show you things it will remove. Just deselect things you actually do want to keep and then remove them. But remember, it will apply configuration tweaks, so be careful.
Whoa. And that just leaves Andrew Gregory.
Mine is actually a rediscovery, and it's I've rediscovered how gosh darn cool Neal Stephenson is. N-E-A-L. He's a writer, but he's also quite a hardcore techie, geeky chap. So much so that on page 480 of the novel that I read last weekend is half a page of Perl script.
Great.
Did
you run it?
I was shocked. It's this novel, Cryptonomicon. It's set in. It's mostly set in World War II. There's a lot about Bletchley Park and
Perl was around
back when Perl was popular.
Well, the action also flips to the present day.
Spoiler alert!
Oh, I've ruined chapter two for you. And there's a discussion of cryptography, and during which this function is expressed as half a page of Perl code.
Cool.
How cool is that?
That's going to be good for the audiobook version, isn't it?
So if you just want to check it out, it's on page 480. Just go to Waterstones, flip through. There it is.
Speaking of World War II cryptography, Alan Turing is apparently forgiven.
What, you mean he's not gay anymore now?
He was gay, but we don't mind anymore.
Oh, cool. That's very big of us.
Yes. After he killed himself for being completely cut off from the rest of his world.
Sod, mate.
Yes. We're very sorry, Alan.
Who's saying sorry?
It's Gordon Brown.
Ah, the Gordon Brown.
Who is the Prime Minister of the UK, for our listeners who don't know that.
A pseudo open ballot. This fortnight is the question, should we focus on other Unixes than just Linux? Of course, we are aware that GNU is not Unix.
GNU's not Unix.
But there are lots of other Unixes out there. GNU is not the only fruit.
Mm-hmm.
For example, OS X, BSD, OpenSolaris. Should we ask...
Minix,
thank you, Mike.
Heard.
Yes.
Well, let's not include that, but...
Should we be pushing these? Should we be, making people aware of this awesome operating system type stuff that's out there?
When the SCO debacle kicked off in 2003, SCO took IBM to court about the whole Linux kernel source code infringing thing, I thought it was great that FreeBSD was around, because if something really bad happened to Linux, we had a very close operating system, a very similar operating system to fall back on, that ran 99% of the same software as Linux. So I think it's a good idea. I think it's good to have a kind of backup. I don't use FreeBSD much these days, but I really like it, because if something terrible happens to Linux, then a lot of us can switch to FreeBSD very quickly without having a major impact.
Well, I'm going to say no. I think it's great that things like FreeBSD are around, and I'm sure they'll continue to be around because people are enthusiastic and they keep up development. Mm. But increasingly now, I think that we need to have a single Linux with a single desktop, supporting and blurring the line between Linux and other free Unixes is diluting our argument. One of the great things about Linux and open source and all that is that there's so much choice. We've talked about that a lot. But I think for a single unified front for the public to try and increase open source support, we have to know. We won't dilute our coverage.
So you think you're going to write to Steve Jobs and say, give up, mate?
I can't do anything about that. But, I think on the open source platform, we should make Linux the shining star of the whole community.
So you won't be selling articles to PC Plus, telling them that Herd, this is the year of Herd on the desktop?
Well, if something else comes along, if FreeBSD overtakes Linux, that's brilliant. That's what competition and open source is all about. But in terms of journalists giving increased kind of coverage to these things, I think it dilutes our argument.
Well, I think it's great for folks to try, go out there and get some ideas. I find it pretty terrifying when you read stories about how Steve Ballmer won't let people use iPhones at Microsoft. Which is terrifying, I think.
Of course, yeah.
Let folks try it, see what they think, see what they like, learn from it, and then try something else, and maybe take their ideas across, steal the best ideas, move on. That's a good idea. That works really well. So, we put up a story about OpenSolaris a couple of days ago on the website, talking about how it differs from Linux. So if you've got some Linux experience, go and check out OpenSolaris. And that was really popular on Slashdot, all over Twitter, Dig. Great. People just want to know.
Yeah,
they're just curious. They
yeah.
want to find out what's good and why it's cool and take the best bits of Linux. So I think it works both ways.
But when stuff patently isn't as good as Linux, for example, the Herd, sorry to pick on it again, surely it's a waste of time for us to give it that much coverage.
But there will be a lot of people who'd say the Herd is technically a better kernel than Linux. Sure, it doesn't have hardly any drivers at the moment, and it's very, very immature.
At the moment.
But
people say that, and they're just coming now to pitchfork.
the Herd is effectively useless at the moment, but its design is fascinating and deeply technical and complicated. But there will be some people who say that is a line worth pursuing in the future.
But is there anything that we can take from that now? I mean, isn't the Herd fundamentally differently designed to a monolithic kernel such as Linux?
It is. It's,
whoa!
It's highly, highly modular. Yeah, you can pull and plug things out while it's still running.
So like a scheduler, for example?
Well, yeah, but you'd have to reboot your Linux machine to change scheduler. You probably have to compile it in to the kernel itself. So the Herd, I see what you're saying, but I think a lot of potentially good ideas could just disappear if we said, let's focus all our energies on what we've got at the moment. Linux could stagnate.
But maybe we should try with our readers, perhaps, of Linux format, just make an issue, the OpenSolaris issue.
No, let's not do that.
No, it's a bit tedious, isn't it? I think at this point, people are beyond Linux being something different, and they're more interested in what differentiates distros. They're at a more fine-grained level now. And that's, I think, very interesting, because it means that if someday we do switch to FreeBSD, it'll boot up into a KDE desktop, and people may not even realise they're not using Linux. When does it become clear they're not using Linux?
I think if the abstraction levels for like hardware management and software installation developed a certain level, then yeah, it doesn't matter if you're running FreeBSD, NetBSD on some random device, and the desktop looks the same.
This sounds like a ringing endorsement for foreign Unixes apart from Graham, who is an avid Mac user. You heard that here first too. And with that, GNU's not Unix and neither is Linux. Love, we come to the end of episode 17 of the podcast. Don't forget, you can find...
Hang on a minute here. How on earth can you be wrapping up the show? You came late to the show. You don't have the right to wrap
it up. The door was stuck.
Oh, yeah, right. We all managed to get in fine. It's just some excuse. It's always another excuse. And because of that, I've got one more thing. In 2006, there was an EU study which calculated the cost to redevelop Linux kernel 2.6.8 in a traditional proprietary setting. I want everybody to guess how much they calculated it would cost to redevelop.
2.7 billion euros.
Okay, that's Andrew's guess, 2.7 billion euros.
I'm waiting for Google to load. 2.71 billion euros.
Really? Okay.
I think 10 billion euros.
I think 10 billion
euros. Why are we talking euros?
The answer is in euros.
The survey was commissioned by the European Union, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Have you not got a mental pound converter for everything that important? That really annoys me. All right. 10 billion pounds. Just to annoy Andrew.
10 billion pounds. Right. 2.7 billion pounds from Andrew. 10 billion.
Euros.
This is confusing.
Who was responsible for doing the work?
It's Swiss francs, Graham. It
wasn't, yeah, Liechtensteiner.
It wasn't anyone in the UK and anybody to do with like the NHS IT project, was it? Okay, I'll be slightly more conservative and go with 1.5 billion krona.
Krona. Which is, no, in euros...
It's far more than that. It's far more.
1.5 billion euros.
Yeah.
The answer is 822 million euros.
Wow, what a bargain. So it would be.
Yeah.
I just mean Graham wins.
It does indeed. Graham, you win today's
The contract.
Yeah. Good luck redeveloping that.
Yeah, going to love doing the NVIDIA stuff.
And with that, we come to the real end of our podcast. Tune in 2 weeks for more wild misestimations of costs and more Linux news and reviews. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye. It's such a nice day to be on the main stage.